Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, registered veterinary nurse Emma Young. Thank you, Emma. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, thank you, Ema. Hello, everybody. Welcome to my CPD, Marvellous Muscles and How Massage Can Help today. My aim today is to provide you with a revision on your canine muscular knowledge and to send you away with a newfound desire to learn more about the canine muscular system and to think about its relevance to patient health and recovery in practice and beyond. So my name is Emma Young and I've been working in practice for 20 years. I've spent 15 years in orthopaedic referral. It is my experience that when a dog is treated for lameness that isn't resolved with rest and medication, radiographs and surgical intervention follow where indicated. Early on in my career, watching my orthopaedic patients both pre- and post-operatively, I became aware very quickly that we, the vet team, were falling short in providing the best possible outcome for some of our patients. Fortunately, this has been changing. The growing market of canine rehabilitation is useful to both the practice, owner and patient. Hydrotherapy, physiotherapy, laser therapy and massage all provide vets, owners and patients with a wide range of helpful and supportive therapies to choose from. Many dogs participate in sports such as canicross, flyball and agility. More recently, daily doggy daycare has become the norm, and this means that many dogs are moving and exercising, often at high intensity, on a regular basis. Muscle mass accounts for nearly half of a dog's body weight, so being mindful of canine muscular health is vital in sustaining optimal health and fitness, along with post-operative recovery. So, marvellous muscles. So we want to think about muscles in practice. It would be useful to apply a general assessment of a dog's musculature, establishing what is normal for each patient, especially prior to any surgeries or lengthy hospital admissions, helps us to support and maintain the health and fitness for each patient. As nurses, we must consider well-being physically as well as emotionally. Muscular assessment can help identify problems with adequate nutrition, mobility or lack of, and pain. What is normal for that patient? Is there pain? Is there symmetry to the body? Are there changes to gait or weight-bearing capabilities? Are there changes to behaviour? Any changes to the way a dog moves can indicate muscular dysfunction, trauma or injury. Too often, we only look for skeletal issues, when in fact it is likely that the soft tissues of the muscular system need addressing also. Skeletal muscle. We all know that there are three types of muscle in the body: cardiac, smooth and skeletal. Skeletal muscle is the only muscle in the body under voluntary control. Skeletal muscle accounts for approximately 44% of the body weight of the average dog and approximately 57% in greyhounds. Skeletal muscles are attached to bone via tendon and the primary function is to assist with movement. Skeletal muscle is either extrinsic or intrinsic. Extrinsic muscles cross over the appendicular and axial skeleton to assist with movement of the whole limb in relation to other parts of the body. The trapezius is a good example of this. Like a shawl, it drapes over the shoulders, connecting the axial and appendicular skeleton. Intrinsic muscles are more local and will be found attached to either the axial or appendicular skeleton. The biceps muscle has both its origin and insertion located on the appendicular skeleton. A muscle is attached to a bone at two points. Its starting point is the origin, and this moves the least during contraction. The opposite end is called the insertion. This has greater movement and is more likely to suffer injury. Not all muscles will have a belly. Some will be flat, like those of the abdominal wall. The muscular system and muscle anatomy. The function of the muscular system is to produce movement or indeed prevent it. Skeletal muscles work to maintain posture and stabilize joints. Simply, skeletal muscle is made up of densely packed bundles of muscle fibers that are wrapped in connective tissue. Looking at the image here, we can see the muscle belly composed of multiple fascicles. These fascicles are small bundles of muscle fibers. The number of muscle fibers an individual possesses is determined by genetics. However, the size of the muscle can be altered with the correct influences of diet and exercise. Myoblasts turn into myocytes following myogenesis. Many myocytes become myofibrils, a muscle fiber. Myofibrils are made up of two proteins, myosin and actin. Myosin is a thick, long fibrous filament with a globular head that binds to actin, a thinner filament, during contraction. Sarcomeres are many myofibrils grouped and wrapped together. Sarcomeres are the functional contractile unit of the muscle. During contraction, the sarcomere will shorten at both ends. Muscle fibers are bound together by endomycium to form a fascicle. Groups of fascicles are bound by perimycium, which forms the muscle belly. Capillaries and nerves that supply the muscle cells can run throughout the muscle layers. Epimycium then covers the whole muscle. This is dense, irregular connective tissue that is continuous, with the endomycium, perimycium, and fascia extending as tendon. This attaches to the periosteum of bone. Muscles form overlapping layers of superficial and deep layers. Skeletal muscle varies in shape and size depending on its position and function. Make them move. Skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. Muscle fibers must be stimulated to contract by nerve impulses. Skeletal muscle is highly elastic with strong contractile power. The number of muscle fibers supplied by one nerve fiber will vary depending on the type of movement required for that muscle. If it is a delicate movement, then a nerve fiber may only innervate a small number of muscle fibers. Where larger movements are required, one nerve may supply 200 or more muscle fibers. A single nerve, together with the muscle fibers it supplies, is called a motor unit. Peripheral nerves are classified according to their function. Sensory nerves carry impulses towards the central nervous system. Afferent nerves carry information about limb position and temperature. Motor nerves carry impulses away from the central nervous system. They carry messages from the brain in response to messages from afferent nerves. These efferent nerves elicit movement and allow adaptations and responses to sensory information given. Mixed nerves do both. Intercalated neurons lie between sensory and motor neurons. Skeletal muscle has two specialized nerve endings to help prevent injury. Golgi apparatus sends messages back to the brain about the position of the muscle, known as proprioception. These are found where the muscle and tendons merge together. The muscle spindle nerve endings prevent overstretching of the muscle fibers, and this is an important safety mechanism to prevent straining of the muscle fibers and injury. Muscular contraction. Contraction of an entire muscle is the result of the cumulative contraction of many motor units. Muscles will contract or relax when they receive signals from the nervous system. A neuromuscular junction is the site of the signal exchange. Muscle fibers are composed of many myofibrils. A myofibril unit contains contractile units called sarcomeres. Sarcomeres run adjacent to one another along the length of a myofibril. Each sarcomere consists of altering thick and thin protein filaments, which gives muscle its striated appearance under the microscope. The sarcomere shortens at both ends when acted upon. Muscle contractions are controlled by calcium. When there is enough calcium ions and ATP available, the calcium ions displace tropomyosin and bind to troponin to start muscle contraction. A contraction begins when a bound ATP molecule is hydrolyzed to ADP, an inorganic phosphate, causing the myosin head to extend. An action called the power stroke is then triggered. This allows myosin to attach to a binding site on the actin to perform the crossbridge and allow the myosin filament to pull the actin filament along its length. The crossbridge exerts forces to move, known as the sliding filament mechanism of muscle contraction. ATP is the energy source of muscle contraction. When the bond between adenosine and phosphate is broken, a phosphate is released and ADP, an inorganic phosphate, is created. Only when a new ATP molecule is bound can the myosin be freed to allow continued contractions. Creatinine phosphate is stored in the muscle, providing the ATP with the energy required to become ATP again. For sustained or prolonged muscular contractions, the body utilizes glycogen from dietary carbohydrates, which is broken down and metabolized by anaerobic glycolysis. I would recommend that you look up the videos on YouTube and such on muscle contraction. They really demonstrate quite vividly exactly what's happening on the cellular level, and really brings everything to life and helps you remember what's going on. Muscle action. Muscles are classified according to their action during contraction. An agonist muscle is the main muscle in the action, the primary mover. An antagonistic is a muscle that opposes the movement of the agonistic muscle. A synergistic muscle works to stabilize and steady joints. Fixator muscles prevent any unnecessary movement. So let's bring this to life now by doing a biceps curl. So do it with me. Lift up your arm and take a moment. Think about all the muscles that are now engaged in this simple movement. A single joint movement through the elbow. The biceps brachii is the agonist. It flexes the elbow, shortening through concentric contraction. Triceps is the antagonist, resisting flexion, extending and lengthening the elbow through isotonic contraction. The deltoids, along with muscles through the back and the forearm, work to stabilize the movement. Brachialis is the synergist, assisting stabilization. And you've also got your pectorals, your flexors and extenders, all assisting in the simple movement of a bicep curl. So there's a lot going on in something very simple. Types of muscle contraction. Isotonic muscle contraction is further subdivided into concentric contraction, where the muscle shortens as it contracts, and eccentric contraction, where the muscle lengthens as it contracts. Think about how a dog can rapidly decelerate from a sprint, or how the muscles have to work when you're walking down a very steep gradient. Isometric contraction, the muscle length or the joint angles do not change. For example, when a dog is carrying something like a stick or a ball in its mouth, or if the dog is stood still. Isokinetic contractions are like isotonic contractions in that the muscle changes length during the contraction, but it differs in that isokinetic contractions produce movements of a constant speed. So that would be like when a dog is swimming, for example. Fast and slow twitch. Fast and slow twitch muscle fibers. So what's the difference? Muscle fibers are classified as either slow or fast twitch. Put simply, fast twitch muscle fibers fatigue more quickly because the energy used to power muscle contraction is produced in smaller quantities. Fast twitch muscle fibers are anaerobic, meaning they do not need oxygen to work. This means that they can readily produce quick bursts of contraction. Fast twitch muscle is utilized for short bursts of activity, high intensity exercise, a bit like a flyball box turn. The contraction of these muscles generates a greater force, but over a much shorter time, which makes them much less resistant to fatigue. So they tire very, very quickly. Slow twitch muscle fibers are aerobic and require oxygen. This means that they are more resistant to fatigue and therefore used for endurance work like those of sled dogs. The ratio of fast and slow twitch fibers is genetically inherited, and so selective breeding assists with the desired athletic ability of your dog, hence why you will get certain breeds for certain jobs, depending on their and how they're built. Motion is lotion. I do not have that on my notes. So flexion, we'll talk about the different way that the body moves. So flexion, when a limb is in flexion, the muscles are working, it reduces the angle between the bones. Extension increases the angle between the bones, so there's a lengthening of the body. Adduction, there's movement towards the central line of the body. Abduction, the limbs work away from the midline of the body. Circumduction, this normally refers to how the lower parts of the limbs are moving actually, and they can move in a circle. Supination is an inversion of the paw, and pronation is eversion of the paw. So origins and insertions. Tendons attach muscle to bone. The tendons of origin is the attachment of muscle to the less movable bone. They are usually bigger and stronger than the insertion attachments. Tendons attach to the periosteum of bone. Tendons can vary in length throughout the body depending on the function of the muscle. Tendons have high tensile strength and can endure huge amounts of tension, usually more than the muscle itself can produce. This means that tendons do not rupture easily, but they are not as elastic as muscle fibers. So following heavy exercise, tendons can remain contracted, and where a tendon is inflamed and contracted, it is at greater risk of being strained or overstretched and subsequently injured. Muscular insertions are tendon attachments where there is greater movement. During contraction, the insertion will be brought closer to the origin. So like with the bicep curl, it shortens it and it brings the insertion closer to the origin. So we're back to our previous slide. Actually, here we are in my notes. I've got them all muddled, so we'll go back to this one. So joint motions are named by the movement of one body segment moving towards or away from another body part. Limb motion is usually described by the motion of the joint and not the body part. So for example, it's better to say elbow flexion and not forearm flexion, because obviously in the forearm you've got the wrists, the elbow and the shoulder, and that there's a lot going on. So you narrow it down so you know exactly what's going on in that limb. So flexion of a limb is retracted or folded. That's quite a nice way to remember it. A digit would be bent, or the back or the neck is arched dorsally. During locomotion, the lumbar spine will flex at varying degrees depending on the speed at which the dog is going. Flexion of a limb closes the distance and the angles between the two bones. The extension of a limb, you're essentially reaching out, extending, lengthening. The digit will extend and the back or the neck will become less arched and movement is more ventral. Joints they become more straightened and the bone angles are wider apart. Any extension before normal range obviously is termed hyperextension, and that's where animals can be more prone to injuries and whatnot, where joints are moving beyond their normal range. So let's go over some origins and insertions and do some revision. I've compiled a list of muscles in the body that I come across very frequently in my work as a canine massage therapist, and ones that are typically we look for that might have suffered some kind of injury or suffering with a trigger point or strain or whatever. So we'll start with the head and neck muscles. So the sternus cephalicus, the splenius, the brachiocephalicus, serratus ventralis, trapezius and rhomboids. So let's start with our origins insertions on sternocephalicus. So the origin is the manubrium, right at the front on the chest. The insertion, the mastoid part of the temporal bone and nuchal crest of occiput. So you can see it right up the back of the head there, right at the back behind the ears. And the action is to draw the head and neck to one side. And obviously if this has suffered an injury, that will be painful for a dog. And we need to be mindful of these sorts of things, particularly when we're in practice, if we're taking blood samples, when we're examining, looking in ears, looking in the mouth, looking at eyes. If there's any kind of injury there, turning... making a dog move too abruptly can cause pain, actually, and you're at risk of being bitten or told off, or at least having a dog saying ouch. So it's very important to be aware of these muscles and actually their impact when we are handling our patients in practice. The splenius is a triangular muscle that extends from the third thoracic vertebrae along the median rafe of the neck. You can see how actually big and wide that is on the diagram on the system there. The origin, the median rafe of the neck of the first thoracic vertebrae, and aponeurosis from the cranial border of the thoracolumbar fascia. The insertion is the dorsal nuchal lines of the occipital bone and mastoid part of the temporal bone. And the action is to extend and raise the neck. Again, if there's a problem here and you're extending a neck for a blood sample, this could be a problem and it's a consideration. So just take things nice and gently. It wouldn't hurt just to rub through the neck muscles just very gently prior to doing taking a blood sample just to warm up the tissue before you get them to move about. Brachiocephalicus. This is a really large muscle split into two at the clavicular intersection. So you've got the top part, the cleidobrachialis, and the second part is the cleidocephalicus. The origin is the clavicular intersection. The insertion of the cleidobrachialis is at the distal humerus, and the origin of the cleidocephalicus is at the nuchal crest of the occipital bone and dorsal raphe of the neck, so right high up where the other two were. And the action is limb protraction and shoulder extension. When contraction occurs, you will see that the head and neck are moved to that side. So we can see this quite a lot in obedience dogs, actually. A lot of working gun dogs that do a lot of work on where they're trained on one side of the handler. Sometimes you will get shortening, and that's why you'll get that, and you'll see that. Serratus ventralis. So the origin is the transverse process of C3 to C7, and the insertion is the serrated face of the scapula. You can see there on the diagram. The action is to support the trunk of the body and draw the limb cranially. Trapezius. So as you see, as I said before, it is like a little bit of a scarf or a shawl over the shoulders there. The origin is C3 to T9 vertebrae and medium raphe of neck. The insertion is the spine of scapula. You can see the whiteness over where the spine of the scapula would be there. And the action, this is very important muscle for limb protraction, rotation, elevation and abduction. So if you have any kind of injury here, all of those things will be affected, and there will be changes in the way that the dog moves and in their gait. Rhomboids. This is a much deeper muscle and actually lays beneath the trapezius, so it's not something you're going to be able to readily palpate and feel unless you've got some practice with massage therapy and the application of massage. However, it's still very relevant and can still throw up a few problems and change the way a dog can move or play or behave if they have suffered an injury with this muscle, or if they've got some trigger points and whatnot going on through that. So this drapes over the neck and shoulders in the same way as the trapezius, just underneath pretty much. And the origin is the nuchal crest of the occipital bone and spinous processes of 7 thoracic vertebrae. The insertion is the medial edge of the scapula. And the action is to elevate the limb and pull the shoulder back and forth. So nice movement there. So shoulder and foreleg muscles. We've got the supraspinatus, deltoideus, latissimus dorsi, the triceps, and superficial and deep pectoral muscles. And again, I've chosen these ones because I found them to be very, very relevant and in my work as a massage therapist, and I seem to have to consider them more frequently than others. So your supraspinatus muscle, that's on like the front half, if you will, of the scapula there on the forelimb. And the origin is the supraspinatus fossa. The insertion is the greater tubercle of the humerus, and the action is to extend and stabilize the shoulder and advance the limb. The deltoids. The origin is the spine, an acromial process of the scapula. The insertion is the deltoid tuberosity of the humerus. It comes down much further, and the action is to flex the shoulder. Latissimus dorsi. Now this is an interesting one and very important, as you can see from the diagram and the picture here, how broad that insertion is and how broad the origin is there, and what a big sheet of muscle it is. And this is particularly important for dogs that have ill-fitting harnesses, for amongst other things. But I'm finding it quite a lot with a lot of tightly fitting harnesses. This is causing quite a few issues. So latissimus dorsi, your origin is the spinous processes of T7 and T8, ribs 11 to 13. The thoracolumbar fascia from spinous processes of the lumbar vertebrae down in the back. And the insertion is the teres major tuberosity and greater tubercle of the humerus. So the action is to flex the shoulder and draw the limb caudally. Just note how far along the vertebrae the origin is, just how wide and how big this biceps muscle is? Your triceps. Origin, caudal border of the scapula. The insertion is the olecranon process of the ulna. And the action is to extend the elbow and flex the shoulder. That's nice. Nice little muscle. Your pectorals, your deep and your superficial. These are very important to consider in practice. A lot of dogs now are living on slippery floors, and it is causing micro traumas and problems to this area of the body. So your origin is your manubrium. The insertion is the greater tubercle of the humerus. The action is to adduct the limb, to keep the limbs where they should be and not be slipping out to the side and prevent abduction when weight bearing. Very important to remember this muscle area, particularly when you're doing nail clips. How many times have your patients turned into little devils and they want to eat you? Often it's so easy when we're doing nail clips to pull the leg out to the side to, you know, abduct that limb away. And actually, if you have micro tears and trauma to this muscle, there will be reduced flexibility there. It will be hard and it will be fibrous and it will cause pain if you pull that leg out to the side rather sharply, and that's where they become uncomfortable. So it's very important when you're doing any kind of examinations and certainly nail clips, work with the range of how the limb is supposed to move, you know, forwards and backwards, but not out to the side, because that will cause a problem. And some dogs, you know, they may just be anticipating pain as well, because there are quite, you know, there's quite a few problems going on there through the pectoral region. So the back and trunk muscles. So we've got the apaxials, the iliocostalis, the external abdominal oblique, internal abdominal oblique, and the intercostals. Again, chosen because these seem to be the muscles that I deal with the most, that sort of come up with, that I have to make considerations for and I find problems and issues with in my massage practice. So the apaxials, this is a muscular system that runs the length of the axial skeleton, and it consists of three longitudinal muscular systems, each with multiple fascicles overlapping several vertebrae. So working medially to laterally, so from the middle to the outer edge, if you like. You've got the transversus spinalis, the longissimus, and the iliocostalis. Now, I have done an origin insertion for the iliocostalis separately because that is a very significant muscle to me in practice, in a lot of patients that I see. But the action is to maintain the posture and to aid locomotion. So, and that's going to flex and extend and provide stability to the body. The back is essentially the dog's core, and the apaxials do work very, very hard. The iliocostalis. Oh, we've got a little bit confused here, but the iliocus, let me just see if I can find it for you. Oh, no. Let me just pop back. Sincere apologies. So the iliocostalis muscle, the origin is the wing of the ilium at the back there. I'll just move this arrow just to show you where the wing of the ilium down there. Okay, and the iliac crest and the intermuscular septum. The insertion is the transverse process of the lumbar vertebrae and ribs 10 to 13. So I'll just move the green arrow so it comes all the way over here. And it's a nice sort of meaty muscle, actually, on the side of the dog's body. And the action is fixation of the vertebral column or lateral movement when only one side contracts. So this aids in respiration by pulling the ribs caudally as well. So the iliocostalis is a very important muscle for the dogs. So the abdominals. So we've got the external abdominal obliques and the internal abdominal obliques. So the externals, the origin is the lateral surface of ribs 4 to 12, and their insertion is the linea alba. The action is the compression and support of the abdominal organs. Internal abdominal obliques, the origin is the coxal tuber of the pelvis, and the insertion is the linea alba. And again, the action is the compression and support of the abdominal organs and viscera. Intercostal muscles. So the intercostal muscles are external muscle fibres that run quadriventrally. The internal muscle fibres run cranioventrally, although each is confined to a single intercostal space. So the origin is the caudal border of the rib, and the insertion is the cranial border of the adjacent rib, and the action is to aid in respiration there. So hind limbs. As you can see, this dog is recovering from a hind limb operation, and there's significant muscle atrophy there to that hind leg. So important hind limb muscles that are come across frequently are sartorius, the gluteals, the bottoms, the gastrocnemius, tensor fascia lata, the quad group, which is your vastus lateralis, your vastus medialis, and your vastus intermedius, your hamstring group, biceps femoris, semimembranosus and semitendinosus, gastrocnemius, and your iliopsoas, your sartorius. So we'll get rid of our arrow because we don't need that anymore. So your sartorius muscle, your origin is the cranial belly, because there's two parts almost, is the lumbodorsal fascia and the iliac crest, and the insertion is the patella. And the caudal belly, the origin there is the cranial ventral iliac spine. The insertion is the cranial tibial border. So the action is to flex the hip and stifle while the limb is being protracted, and to contribute to stifle extension during stance. Click on. And your gluteals. So you've got your middle and your superficial. So broadly speaking, the origin is the iliac crest, the insertion is the greater trochanter of the femur, and the action of the gluteals is to extend the hip, abduct the thigh, and rotate medially. These work very, very hard in dogs with hip dysplasia. When you're out walking your dogs and out and about in parks and stuff, when you see typically German Shepherd, the dogs, when they're squatting to have a poo, that are wandering along, we refer to it as a wandering poo. The gluteals are working super, super hard, and often they've got lots of strains, and they're very dysfunctional, and they need a lot of extra help, and they just don't have the strength there to support the pelvis, because they have to work so hard to try and stabilize that whole area when there's a lot of movement with the hip joint itself. So these often need a lot of TLC as a massage therapist. Important to point out, it's very easy for us when we're asking for a dog to give us a sit in practice. If we want to do an examination, take a blood sample, or just sit still, potentially you can press on what is an owie for the dog. You know, it's going to hurt. So just be mindful of how you're touching your patients and handling your patients, and be mindful of the muscular system, that there might be something there going on that is sore and is going to be uncomfortable for your patient. So your tensor fascia lata. So your origin is your tuber coxae and the aponeurosis of the middle gluteal. So everything's all linked together, and where you've got a problem in with one muscle group, it will sort of go on to the neighbouring one as well. The insertion is the lateral femoral fascia. The action, it tenses the fascia during locomotion, flexes the hip and extends the stifle. Very important. This one is often quite tender in my own dog, actually. I have a Springer Spaniel. He's very sort of springy, as you'd imagine, and this often has trigger points and problems for him, and I often do a lot of work on this particular muscle for him. And it's very important for dogs that compete in sports such as flyball and agility, I've noted. So your quad group, so your vastus lateralis, your vastus medialis, and your vastus intermedius. Origin, proximal lateral femur, your insertion, tibial tuberosity, and your action is to extend the stifle. So your hamstring group. So, biceps femoris. Your origin is your ischial tuberosity and sacrotuberous ligament. Insertion is the fascia lata. Again, see everything's interlinked and works together and helps each other out somewhat and is very much linked. The crural fascia and the tubercalcani. The action of the biceps femoris is to extend the hip and hock and extend and flex the stifle. Semitendinosus, the origin is the ischial tuber. The insertion is the medial tibial body and tubercalcani, and the action is to extend the hip, flex the stifle, and extend the hock. Semimembranosus, origin, ischial tuber, insertion, distal medial femur and medial tibial condyle, the action to extend the hip, flex and extend the stifle. Gastrocnemius, so your calf muscle. Your origin, natural and medial supracondylar tuberosities of the femur. The insertion, tubercalcani, and the action is to extend the tarsus and flex the stifle. Again, very important muscle and often can get quite hypertonic, a little bit knotty. A lot of dogs seem to like that being kneaded and worked on because it does work quite hard a lot of the time. Iliopsoas, this is a very deep muscle. You're never going to be able to palpate this one. However, it is a very important muscle concerning sporting and working dogs. Strains from excessive stretching or repetitive strains or just participating in highly athletic activities, strains and injuries to this muscle is common. However, it can be quite underdiagnosed. It can be a tricky one, but a lot of your professional physiotherapists and canine rehabilitation therapists know a lot about the iliopsoas muscle. So the origin here is the transverse processes of the lumbar vertebrae 2 and 3 and by means of aponeurosis to the 3rd and 4th lumbar vertebrae and finally on the ventral and lateral surfaces the 4th to 7th lumbar vertebrae. The insertion is along the iliacus muscle to the lesser trochanter of the femur. And the action is to draw the pelvic limb forward by flexion of the hip joint. And when the femur is in a fixed position, it gives flexion and fixation to the vertebral column. And when the leg is extended, it draws the trunk backwards. It's a very important muscle. And as I say, in sporting dogs specifically, but actually all dogs, because a lot of them run around, you know, chasing these chuckets and frisbees and whatnot, it is prone to being injured and strained. So what is a strain? Here we've got a lovely ultrasound showing you what a strain is and a gorgeous collie participating in agility. So, I didn't mean to do that. Let's go back. So what is a strain? So a strain is a tear to the muscle or tendon caused by overstretching or overloading. This is not to be confused with a sprain, which is damage to a ligament. So a strain, the T for tendon. There are three grades of strain. Grade 1, 10% of the muscle fibres are affected. Grade 2, 50% or so of muscle fibres are affected. And a grade 3 is a complete rupture. Strains are further subdivided. So we would classify them as a chronic strain, also known as a repetitive strain injury. And this occurs following prolonged repetitive movements that cause micro tears within the muscle tissue or the tendon. This is common in dogs that participate in sports, such as agility and flyball. And they are also common in dogs that have orthopaedic conditions, such as hip and elbow dysplasia, simply because there will be muscular dysfunction where the muscles have to work very hard to provide splinting and support of joints that are working and moving abnormally. And they're just under a lot of strain and therefore they get this injury. An acute strain obviously happens from direct trauma and is acute sudden problem to the body or overstretching of the muscle fibers suddenly causing an immediate tear to the soft tissues. And this can be caused by slipping on laminate flooring, chasing a ball or a squirrel, jumping very dynamically in the park suddenly, just that little bit more awkwardly, and they will encounter a muscular strain. And dogs come into practice often with intermittent lameness that we can't really put our finger on it as to what's going on, and we might recommend x-rays and we might do x-rays and not really find anything, but actually what the dog is experiencing is a strain restrain cycle, and the problem is, depending on the activities that they're doing at home and sort of sporting things and their walks and whatnot that they're participating in, they can be in a situation where they're straining, they have a period of healing, and then they restrain and they're in pain. So once the tissue has repaired, that the body doesn't repair it with like for like tissue. You get a much more fibrous, tougher tissue that is up to 50% less flexible than the soft tissues that were originally there, which means that it is at a greater incidence of restraining again. It's just not quite as flexible as it used to be, and that's going to cause a problem for the dog. So you will just sometimes have dogs come in with just this intermittent problem, and that's where it's very important to ask lots of questions, what the dog is participating in and what they're doing, and to see if you can help them actually at home with that to prevent further problems. So, you know, what do we see in real life and in veterinary practice as nurses when owners come in with problems and with their patients? So daily living for modern dogs does present obstacles and considerations for both the owner and the veterinary practice. And they're considerations that we didn't really need to think of. You know, 20 years ago when I was first in practice, I think modern daily living for our canine companions is quite different now. So I've laid out just a few that are sort of up there to really think of on a daily basis. And the first one is weight. More and more dogs are carrying excessive weight, and it's often really difficult for owners to be quite subjective when body scoring their own dogs. And that's where we, the nurses, really need to help owners with this. And we need to utilise our nurses' clinics and body condition score charts to support our message and try and help the owners understand and see, you know, that actually their dog is carrying a little bit too much weight, because where there is excessive weight, no doubt there will be muscular dysfunction, because the body will attempt to protect itself from painful loading on the joints. This is particularly important concerning breeds that are at risk of diseases such as hip dysplasia, the bigger breeds of dogs that are at risk of cruciate ligament disease and elbow OCD and so on and so forth. We know that excessive weight causes inflammation in the body. So where you have a senior dog that may already be suffering with arthritis, the excess weight will cause inflammation in the body. And that will, you know, manifest as pain and discomfort, reduced mobility and so forth for the dog. So number two, jumping in and out of the car, big problem. Cars are getting bigger, much bigger than ever before, and everyday action for dogs to be jumping in and out of the van, be it the dog walking van or the family car. So it really is important to find out, you know, how high is the back of that car. Repetitive jumping out of the car is believed to exert forces of up to four times the dog's body weight through those four limbs, you know, through the wrists, the elbows and the shoulders. The flexor and extensor muscle groups further down the limb, they will be under repetitive stress, leading to micro tears and trauma, which will cause pain and reduce mobility. You will see increased tension through the neck and the shoulder girdle. That will build up as the body attempts to sort of brace and support the loading as the dog jumps in and out of the car. And certainly where a dog is painful, the body will brace even more, it will become more dysfunctional, you'll get more trigger points, more congestion and more pain. So we really need to sort of ask our clients, you know, what is the vehicle that they have to get in and out of on a regular daily basis. Dogs that live on slippery flooring, this is a big problem. The best floor for dogs by far is carpet. In my massage clinic, when I go to see people in their homes, the dogs that live on carpet are in much better muscular health than the dogs that are living on the slippery floor. Our quest to keep our homes beautiful and clean. It does make sense to have a floor that can be cleaned and disinfected quickly. We've seen it in practice where you've got these, highly hygienic floors, the dogs slip on them. It's very difficult for them to get a decent foot purchase on the floor. Dogs walk on their tiptoes, and that's incredibly difficult on floors such as laminate, tile, and wood flooring. Try it yourself. Stick a pair of fluffy socks on and walk about on your tiptoes, run about on your tiptoes, and just be mindful of actually how you've got to brace your body, support yourself that little bit more, think about what you're doing, and how much easier it is to slip. And the slipping is easy to see. It's evident to see with wet feet. You see the scuff marks on the floor. So we, you know, it would be easy for an owner to see that their dog is in fact slipping. Even the little ones, that they struggle with this. And there's lots of videos online, lots of funny videos of dogs doing lots of lovely things. But oh my gosh, they do make me wince when you actually start watching the limbs move and slip all over the place. That is going to cause trauma and micro tears and problems to the muscle of the body. So, this has a it has a negative impact on many of the muscle groups, but most notably the pectoral muscles of the chest and also the pectineus, which is down in the groin. Again, this is very important. If you're doing a nail clip on a hind limb, don't bring that leg out to the side. Work in the plane of natural movement. Either bring the leg forward gently or back and away from it, but not out to the side, because you're at risk of getting bitten. Because if there's a tear or a problem with that pectineus down there, it's going to be super painful, and that's going to be a problem. The flexor and extensor groups, both front and back bilaterally, are under a lot of pressure to try and stabilize the limb, and work hard to support all the muscles to keep the limbs where they should be and not splayed away from the body. Doggy daycare. Number four, I've got down here, doggy daycare. Well, always ask a client what the daily exercise plan is. Sometimes this can be 5 days at doggy daycare, where a dog can spend hours balancing in the transport vehicles, getting to and from whatever they're doing, be it a field or an actual walk. And of course, depending on the group of individuals that they're with, they could potentially be participating in daily high intensity interval training walks. They're basically doing a HIIT session 5 days a week. You will get muscular dysfunction where you're not sort of stretching that body out and needing out those muscles. Some dogs, on the other hand, don't do very much Monday to Friday, with owners that are busy at work. They become what we call weekend warriors. So they will have long weekend walks, often on varied terrain and undulating ground. And this can lead to delayed onset muscle soreness in the following 48 hours. So ideally, we want dogs that have regular exercise, bespoke to their individual needs and capabilities, with appropriate warm-up and rest periods. Exercise, it really needs to be age, weight, and ability appropriate. And it has to be quite bespoke. And we really want to try and educate and talk to our owners when they are trying to choose doggy daycare, for example, to ask, will my elderly dog be going out with a group of elderly dogs, or is it going to be going out with a group of, adolescent dogs that are going to be bouncing all over the place? This is going to have a problem, for the muscular system potentially. Number five, over-enthusiastic owners with their over-enthusiastic exercise protocols. So the owners with the chuck-its on every single walk, the owners that take their dog to agility class once a month. I had that recently in practice. Little dog came in, he had a really sore back, and we took some x-rays. And it wasn't until I discharged him that I was chatting to the owner about this, that, and the other, rest, getting in and out of the car, and flooring, and whatnot, that she happened to mention, so he can't do agility next week. And this client had spent a significant amount of money having her dog x-rayed, and we'd established that he's got sore back, and we recommended rest. I was like, no, absolutely not. This dog should not be participating in agility, even if it is just once a month, because he loves it. He was a little bit on the chubby side as well, and not a dog I would have said would have worked well on the agility circuit necessarily. So we had a chat about that as well. So sometimes we just need to have open-ended questions with our clients and find out exactly what are they doing, how are they playing with them, is there excessive tuggy, are they throwing a ball inside on a slippery wooden floor, things like that, because what you and I might do with our dogs, other people will do very different things, and we have to ask, these open-ended questions just to find out exactly what's going on. Over-enthusiastic exercise protocols, they will have a detrimental effect upon the muscular system, and it will encourage muscular dysfunction. It will increase incidence of injury, and it will aggravate potential skeletal changes through the joints, particularly if they're overweight as well. So six, are sporting dogs. It's my experience, Canicross dogs aside, actually, I've not ever treated a Canicross dog, and I've not had one come into the surgery that I'm aware of, veterinary surgery or massage surgery. The dogs that do participate in sports, such as flyball and agility, often do not have owners that are equally fit and conditioned to the sport that they are participating in. So this means that the owners are completely unaware of delayed onset muscle soreness. They're completely unaware of onset muscle soreness. They have not experienced firsthand the benefits of a warm-up prior to exercise. They're unable to fully appreciate the physical impact the sport is having on the body. The repetitive nature of agility and flyball promote injury via lack of owner knowledge regarding the fitness and the conditioning required to participate in these highly dynamic sports, often poor technique and sometimes overwork, just owner knowledge. So where you've got somebody that's very knowledgeable, if they've got a good trainer, a good club, they will take into consideration these things, and they do look after their dogs very well, and they do explore complementary therapies to help support their dogs. But sometimes, a bit like the weekend warriors, you've got people that sort of dip in and out of these for fun, that can be a bit of a problem for the dog from time to time. And then number six of all, conformation of our dogs. Exaggerated physical appearance that is not conducive to healthy pets. We've all taken radiographs of dogs with abnormally shaped long bones, be it a lack of tail, which is so important for balance as well as communication. Dogs where their leg length versus the spinal length is all a bit skew with. Facial deformities that inhibit breathing and cooling during exercise. Is the dog doing what it's bred for? All dogs have the same muscles, but how those muscles act upon the skeleton produce movement do vary depending on their conformation. So that's something to just be mindful of. You can't take a bulldog, for example, out for a 10K run. It's just not designed for that. Harnesses, I don't like them at all. I haven't read any papers on scientific data, but from my own personal experience in practice and in the massage clinic, I really don't like them. Unless utilised for our more immobile patients to assist with lifting, mobility for post-op surgeries or during very senior years where, particularly for the bigger dogs, just getting them up and moving, you do need a harness just to help with the lifting, to help the dog when they are getting fatigued. I would prefer if all dogs were just taught to walk properly on the lead, and off the lead for that matter. It's my personal opinion and my belief that if you teach a dog to walk, a whole host of issues are removed, and the building blocks actually for balance fitness begin. You have a balanced walk, and then you can build on that with a strong dog, with a strong core, and start looking at different sort of terrains and sort of exercise programs and whatnot. Very few harnesses fit properly. Owners like to buy what they think looks nice. Many do not consider the function of the harness. Often they buy it for to stop the dog pulling, or the conformation of the dog that they have. Many will clearly have a negative impact on the natural movement of the scapula and the forelimb when the dog's moving through all of the gait patterns, that they're just so tight and they just cut in. The anti-pull harnesses are particularly unhelpful, I think, to the muscular system. They're designed to pinch and to limit forelimb protraction. They close the joint spaces. They limit natural movement. Many are just too tight around the lateral chest space. They are interfering with thoracic and lumbar muscle groups. And, you know, remember that the vast coverage of the latissimus dorsi muscle and your intercostal muscles there, where you've got, you know, a tight strap around the body, that is going to cause problems and restrictions and adhesions. You know, we put harnesses on animals when we want them to pull something like a carriage or a sled. So I do think we should be trying to try and encourage our dog owners to train their dogs to walk properly, nicely on the lead to heel without the use of harnesses where possible. Right, so common stresses of, let me just whiz through. Sorry about this. Let me just go back to this. I'll go back to this one. Bipolar's pain. So common stresses. So we'll look at common stress areas of the body as well. So this, I've incorporated this into the talk today. Again, it's just common things are common, and there seems to be a regular theme with certain breeds of dogs I'm finding, certainly, and that comes from conformation and their size, actually. So looking at the neck and shoulder area, small dogs, you know, the Maltese Terriers, the Shih Tzus, the Mini Dachshunds, the Tiddlers of the canine world, they spend a lot of time looking up. Now, we, the humans, we have the completely opposite problem nowadays. Our reliance on mobile phones and endless scrolling of Instagram and Facebook means that we are in fact suffering with the opposite problem, and our poor posture is associated with looking down at our phones, and we have a sore neck and shoulders as a result. So the small dogs have the opposite problem. Too much looking up. It puts a lot of stress and tension and a heavy workload actually on the neck and shoulder girdle and the muscles through that area. Dogs that enjoy tuggy too much, you know, killing that toy, the repetitive and ferocious nature that we see when they're really killing that toy and having an awful lot of fun, it can cause micro tears to the muscle tissue. Trigger points will develop through that muscle tissue, and that will then trap some nerves and cause referred pain and discomfort and tightening. The Bull Terriers, the Bull breeds, they all have these big, massive necks, and they have a lot of tension through their neck and shoulder area. Certainly when I go up to Battersea on a voluntary basis to go in there to massage the dogs, the Bull Terriers really like a good knead through their neck and shoulder area just to release all that off, just because they're very forward loading and the way they really love to play. And it all sort of accumulates through that area. So a dog that's always licking their forelimb with no obvious reason, so there's no obvious dermatitis, there doesn't appear to be a foreign body of a grass seed or anything, there isn't a growth there, we know there isn't any skeletal pain or sensitivity, that can indicate that the dog might be experiencing referred pain further up in the neck and shoulder area, and it's just firing off down by the paw. So that's something that we must think of. And a lot of dogs, actually, when they come in, they really do like their neck and their shoulders, you know, being rubbed out and rubbed through. It does help ease with any tension and anxiety being in practice. So chest, going back to living on slippery floors, it does cause micro tears to the pectoral muscles in the chest. And again, it is very important to move those limbs through their natural motion wherever possible when we're working in practice. You know, you don't want to be at an increased bite risk because you've, you know, accidentally, and you've not meant to, you've hurt the dog, and it's just one of those things, but it's because it's got really sore muscles there, where it's through the chest, where it's having to live on slippery floors. You know, the muscles have to work harder to brace and protect the body from slipping, it does become contracted down, it does become inflexible and adhered. Again, with the neck and shoulders, you know, does the dog wear a harness that is ill-fitting? Is it tight and pinching? The collars, is it a very wide collar? Is it too tight? What material is the collar made from? Does it have a massive buckle on it that's going to dig in when the dog's trying to rest and sleep? You know, does it interfere with sleeping even? Some can be so big. And where there is pain, local musculature will attempt to brace and support those areas that are constricted and congested. And then you get the pain cycle where everything's a bit dysfunctional and there's problems and the muscle isn't moving like it should do or it would want to, and everything gets a bit congested. So with the lumbar region, the lower back, very common stress area of the body, we do think that back pain and discomfort in dogs is as prevalent as that of humans. The back is essentially a bridge that connects the forelimbs with the hind limbs. It's very flexible. It has to do a lot of flexion and extension through the various gaits. But, you know, yes, it's flexible and it's strong and it's stable. But activities of daily living, along with predisposition, you know, for intervertebral disc disease and conformation, all play a part in this problem. So where there is instability along the spine, abnormal movement will occur. Where there is excessive immobility, abnormal muscular function will occur. So the back is susceptible to wear and tear, you know, much like us, the humans. So, you know, watch a greyhound in full flight and you can really understand the importance of you know, a healthy back, a flexible back that's strong and able to move as it should. So whether as a result of wear or tear or conformational reasons, such as, you know, French bulldogs and pugs, you know, sometimes more and more I'm seeing coming through, there is an absence of a tail. There is curvature of the spine on x-ray. The back is a common area of muscular tension and discomfort. Dogs do have issues that we know, you know, such as spondylosis, athletic injury or trauma, you know, be it to the apexials or the iliopsoas muscles there, any chondrodystrophy, intervertebral disc disease, as I said before, that will all cause a problem for dogs. But with the ever-growing market for all things canine, there is an increasing number of people I'm seeing on Instagram and Facebook that are offering canine conditioning sessions, with the primary goal to condition your dog to optimal fitness by working on their core, and that's essentially strengthening and working on their back. I would really recommend investigating these individuals with great care, really investigate them and find out what are their qualifications. They have the potential to do far more harm than good. I would recommend in practice where you might have somebody whose dog participates in agility or flyball, or they've had an injury or a surgery that you know you need to increase their body conditioning and core strength, look for a accredited and regulated physiotherapist. That would be my point of contact. You just don't want to have, you know, be in practice and work hard and have a fantastic surgical intervention that can be completely ruined by an inexperienced, underqualified therapist that actually doesn't know what they're doing. They've got a few blow up balls and this, that and the other, but they don't really know what they're doing, and they could potentially cause problems. So look for your regulated physiotherapists to help you with your core conditioning and any back problems that your patients may have. So application in practice. So obesity, you know, as I've said before, is one of the biggest health problems for our dogs. Owners seem to like them squishy and cuddly. And, you know, apart from just contributing to the potential for diabetes and heart disease, osteoarthritis does remain the biggest problem affecting, you know, the skeletal system, but of course as well the muscular system, because it's the muscles that work along, you know, upon those bones. And this is especially true of dogs as they get older. So any excessive load bearing on the joints, coupled with inappropriate exercise, it's a recipe for issues. You know, you get cranial cruciate rupture and osteoarthritis as they get older, intermittent forelimb lameness in heavier dogs that jump out of high-backed cars, intermittent back discomfort in dogs that live on laminate floor and slip frequently. Arthritis is affecting 4 out of 5 dogs. It's progressive and incurable, that manifests with, you know, painful degenerative joints. These, you know, arthritis causes reduced mobility, and pain, you know, if it's not managed properly. So certain breeds are more predisposed. Activities of daily living can promote the development also. And this is where your nurses' clinics will be invaluable to clients and patient. We've all come across that client who's concerned that the dog's lame. And then they go on to say, oh, but I don't think he's in any pain. You know, arguably where there's lame, there's pain, and waiting for obvious signs of pain is very unhelpful for our patients. They don't vocalize discomfort routinely. You know, that's just not a normal way of showing signs that they're in pain. We need to ask about changes in behavior, exercise tolerance, their ability to do normal things. The list is endless, and we as nurses, I found in practice, if we can ask open-ended questions, that works much better. I don't know why I've jumped forward. There we go. So this is a tool that you can actually download off the Canine Massage website, and it's the 5 Pillars of Pain. You can download it, print it off, use it in practice. So you can either have it as a laminated sheet in practice as a point of conversation and questions, or you can print off quite a few and send them out with your senior booster reminders. And it just highlights things that you can go through with your client just to investigate whether or not we have a dog, a patient that could be in pain and actually might need something that, you know, needs addressing either medically, surgically, or via a complementary therapy, or indeed all of the above. So it's going to ask you about gait. You know, have they noticed a change in the way that their dog moves? Is there any lameness? Is there any stiffness? Are they hopping? Are they throwing a leg, either abducting it or adducting it? Is there a change to the posture? You know, the top line of the dog, the back of the dog, is that the same? Or is there any curving or hunching? The tail carriage, does it wag the way it used to? My dog recently had an acute back flare up, and it suddenly occurred to me that his tail hadn't been going around doing the helicopter whirl like it had been for a little while, and he's not done that for a little while, and that's my go-to, and it's only recently that's coming back, and that's been a good month or so. So it just gives you little pointers for, you know, things for owners to consider. Activities of daily living, you know, are they struggling to get up and down from the sofa? Are they pacing at night? Are they slowing down on walks? Are they slipping a bit more in the home? Are they laying down to eat? Are they having trouble getting in and out of the car? Has their behaviour changed? You know, is there reluctance to be petted or groomed? Are they quieter? Is there any evidence of self-mutilation, excessive licking of a limb or a joint? Are they snappy now? Are they snappy with other dogs on walks like they never have been before? Have they become a little bit more anxious? And it's also going to ask you about performance. You know, for agility dogs, you know, have they started knocking poles or measuring jumps? With any gun dogs in your practice, are they experiencing early onset fatigue and retrieval issues? Have you got canicross dogs that are fatiguing earlier, or do they have a reluctance to wear their harness? Obedience dogs, is there a change in their work positions? Flyball dogs, are they turning wide at the jump? Is there a change in their technique suddenly? Are they avoiding jumps? You know, all sorts of things. And this is a lovely tool, particularly if you do send it out prior to a free health check or a booster. It just gives the owners time to look through it and have a little think, you know, and they're going to take their dog out for a walk and they might look at them differently for a change in a way that they've not done in a little while. And then that will open up conversations, and that means you can help the patients, which is always a good thing. So trigger points, myofascial pain and the pain cycle. So I've mentioned trigger points very briefly before, but I've not told you precisely what they are just yet, and their relevance to muscular health and muscular dysfunction. So in practice, it would be helpful to think about the four T's of muscular tissue. So particularly when we have hospitalized patients, and particularly those patients that have had surgeries, be it platings, TPLOs, TTAs, and TTTs, think of muscular, the temperature, the tone, the texture, and any tenderness. So when assessing the temperature, use the back of your hand. You know, is the muscle, is it hot? Because that would indicate some inflammation, trauma, pain potentially. Is it cold? You know, is there a problem with the circulation? Is that compromised? Do you know why the muscle feels that way? The tone of the muscle, is the muscle hypertonic? Has it become harder, more immobile, solid? If you've ever gone to the gym and you've not been for a little while, you know about it. And if you've done squats, you know about it walking down the stairs, and actually you can feel it in your muscular tissue in your thighs. Your muscles just become harder and there's more tone there, and it's painful. Or indeed, has the muscle become flaccid? Is it atrophied compared to the other muscles? How does it compare? Is there symmetry there? Texture, are there hard spots? Are there ripples? Are there ridges? Are there depressions in the tissue? How has it changed? Again, is there symmetry? Compare it to the other side. Tenderness in the muscle, is there a pain response to gentle touch? How painful is it, if at all, obviously. Trigger points, myofascial pain and the pain cycle. A trigger point is a hyper-irritable, palpable nodule of contracted muscular tissue. So basically, it's an area of the muscle that's contracted down and it's not uncontracted, it's stayed, and it's a knot. We know them as knots. If you've been for a massage before and your therapist has said, oh, you're very knotty through your shoulders and your back there, and it's quite uncomfortable, and you have this palpable nodule, this knot within the tissue. These are common in all dogs and humans. They are a fact of life. They manifest as a result of daily living, and indeed of overwork, repetitive motion, and sudden or excessive stretching. Basically, what's happened is it's the exhaustion of the muscle fibres. It leads to an ATP deficit within the sarcomere of the muscle fibres. The muscle is unable to uncontract because it's run out of energy. The application of some heat therapy can sometimes help, actually, a little bit, and gentle massage. Trigger points, they can cause debilitating discomfort and pain, particularly if they take a nerve with them. They will restrict range of motion of limbs. That will affect quality of life. If they've taken a nerve with them, there could be a pain signal firing all the time. And as you've got here on the slide, you know, where you've got the contraction of the muscle, it causes a problem with the circulatory retention of the metabolites, so you get all the toxins that build up in that area. The muscle can spasm a little bit, causes restrictive movement, which leads to overcompensation of the body in other areas, which means that the joints don't move as well as they should do. Everything gets congested and adhered and all knotted up, and then you get pain. And then you're just in this cycle of just being knotted up and uncomfortable. And actually, a trigger point, can be quite significant if it causes local ischemia, where there's oxygen and nutrient deprivation to the site, and that will lead to muscle weakness over a long period. You get patterns of referred pain, and that can manifest as self-mutilation and chewing, or even scratching, actually, in an area. My dog will scratch the back of his head, and it's not because he's itchy in that area. That is actually a trigger point and pain there that he's experiencing, and I tend to deal with that for him with massage. So, in practice, we need to consider the grumpy dogs that don't want to be handled or restrained, the dogs that are overly stressed and anxious, if they have exaggerated twitching or fasciculations in areas of the body. You'll see it notably bilaterally in the thoracic region. They'll be quite twitchy, and if you touch them, even very, very gently, they'll turn and sort of look and say, "What are you doing?" And they'll sort of anticipate pain, and they'll be quite uncomfortable. Dogs in ill-fitting harnesses, this is a big problem for them, dogs that are exercising inappropriately. An acute worsening of an existing orthopaedic condition can be attributed to a local or distant trigger point, where the muscles have just got quite congested. You've got this trigger point, and it's just causing all sorts of problems, reducing mobility and joint range of motion. Myofascial pain arises when the fascia, which is like a 3D cobweb of connective tissue of the body, encapsulates absolutely everything, the fascia, when that becomes restricted and stiff, and sometimes it become spasmodic and painful to touch. That will take nerve endings with it as well. I recently went to a talk, and I forget the lecturer's name, but she was telling us they believe that fascia has 8 times more nerve endings within it compared to muscular tissue. So you can appreciate that where there's any kind of constriction or restriction, where there's a lot more nerve endings in there, that's going to cause a pain problem, and refer pain to other areas of the body. So fascia is hugely important for muscular health. It works to reduce the friction. So the myofascia, basically its job is to enable muscles to slide and glide and move freely over each other. Remember, we've got the superficial and the deeper muscle layers, and everything sort of joined and linked in somewhere along the line. And the job of fascia is to stabilize and enclose and separate, but allow for sliding and gliding and free movement. So affected areas of fascia will become too stiff, resulting in fibrosis and adhesions and taking nerves with them, causing pain. It inhibits function, differentiating between adjacent structures, and it will just manifest as tight areas of the body that can be quite sore. Tightening of the fascia and problems with the fascia does then overstimulate the nociceptors of the body, the sensory neurons that respond to stimuli by sending a possible threat signal to the brain. These nociceptors are perceiving pain more readily, and they exacerbate the pain cycle. Restricted fascia can constricts muscle fibers, nerves, lymphatic and blood vessels, causing distortion in pain perception and exaggerating it. You may see sometimes on the skin, it's easier to see on flatter haired dogs actually. The dog's coat may lay differently, or areas might actually stick up. So you'll try and flatten down the fur and it won't, it remains sort of stuck up and laying in an opposite direction. That will often indicate a problem with the fascia underneath, and that's all a bit constricted and that needs releasing off. And I would recommend that you go on appropriate massage courses to teach you how to do that properly, or indeed seek the help of a canine massage therapist to help with that. Can bring enormous relief. I had a dog with wide radiating myofascial pain, was causing her huge problems. Like, you could barely touch the side of her chest. She was so uncomfortable. First session, she needed a muzzle and a Rona to help me. Second session, she still needed a muzzle, but she laid down and she was happy for me to help her. And the third session, I had a dog that readily came onto the massage couch. No muzzle, no owner interventions. She was more than happy for me to sort of help her and release that fascia. So it can, some of the manipulations and things that we do can be slightly uncomfortable, but she definitely learnt that I was there to help her, and I, you know, apparently did relieve her of her pain and what she was the discomfort she was experiencing. So, you know, pain in a joint due to elbow dysplasia leads to restricted movement. The neighbouring soft tissues overcompensate by splinting and bracing, and that limits the movement further, loading other limbs and joints. And where you have myofascial pain and trigger points, very rarely will non-steroidal anti-inflammatories help with that. It often is physical massage therapies and other medications actually that will help with neuropathic pain and the myofascial pain with that. So sometimes you just need to broaden your toolkit actually for dogs that are experiencing these sorts of issues. So, benefits of massage and looking after the muscular system. Massage and its appropriate application in practice is incredibly helpful incredibly helpful for post-operative patients and the long-stay patients. You know, they're spending a lot of time in a kennel, often in the same position. They're not getting out moving as much as we would like them to. Sometimes they have to have other things going on. They are in pain. And so massage really will benefit those patients. Even our day-to-day cases, you know, the dogs that come in for the day to be x-rayed or for other procedures, you know, we're not all blessed with stretchers and these beautifully built hospitals with wide open doorways that we can wheel our patients through on stretchers from room to room. I know in my practice we have to carry heavy anaesthetized patients, and actually we can injure our patients without realizing it, be it in the positions that we're required to get the perfect radiographic image for interpretation, so that, you know, that can leave animals tender for 48 hours following a procedure. Some animals come in and they require long operations whereby they're in a fixed position, and that will cause muscular congestion and problems as well. So we need to just be mindful of what's going on in the whole body system and not just what they're in for, and how it can affect the whole body. You know, many dogs will spend hours in the kennels during their recovery, and when muscles aren't used, they do downregulate very rapidly. Problems with insufficient feeding and nutrient uptake will impact on the muscle mass and their ability to exert normal forces required for normal movement and things like elimination. You know, just going out and squatting to do a poo can be a problem. You know, we learn when we're doing our theory work, you know, the Roper, Logan and Tierney model of human nursing is taught to vet nurse students, and massage in practice is right up there at number 8. You know, it's very important. We know that hospital wards are noisy and they impact on sleep and rest of our patients, and especially practices where there's 24-hour care. You know, the lights are always on, the radio might be on all day, they're busier practices where you've got these big referral centres, you've got a lot of staff, you've got a lot of patients, there's a lot of pumps that are bleeping endlessly, it seems, amongst other things. And we know that noise and kennel stress do lead to increased pain medication requirements, and that's where massage of our patients can really help, because where we can, you know, apply massage appropriately, we can improve joint mobility, we can reduce pain, we will be releasing endorphins, making our patients feel happier, we will be removing toxins, so we're assisting the body to promote the healing of the body, we're going to exercise atrophied muscles. We're going to then be increasing the oxygenation of the tissues, improving the relaxation of our patients, which will then reduce the pain and their need for the pain meds. We're going to mobilise the fibrous adhesions, break down soft tissue adhesions, and then assist with lymphatic drainage, you know, particularly important for distal limb edema, I found in practice following, you know, procedures like TTAs and whatnot, just very, very gentle effleurage and very, very gentle mobilizations of the limb can be very helpful with the edema. But again, it's very important not to focus on the one thing that the animal came in for. So it's very easy for a dog to come in, let's say for a TTA, and we focus on that leg. And actually, we need to support the rest of the body because it's the rest of the body that is going to be working over time so that that leg can heal appropriately. So, applications of massage that you would potentially use in practice. Effleurage is the place to start. Swedish massage, it's the most common and helpful form of massage that can be utilised in practice by all members of the team. Its application is very much on a superficial level of the muscular system, but it really does encourage relaxation and muscle softening, which can be so important to our patients that are sitting in a kennel for a long period of time. Patients that have been lame for a long time, don't worry about the leg that's sore so much, it's the other three that have been really working very hard and they could really do with some extra help. So we're going to be promoting circulation and this is going to be obviously particularly helpful for recumbent patients that aren't moving around so much. Gentle application can assist with distal lymphedema, as I've said previously, promoting lymphatic drainage, and that helps with everything else. Obviously, we wouldn't want to apply this with our cancer patients because assisting and promoting lymphatic drainage will not, you know, is clearly contraindicated in cancer patients. We don't want to assist the cancer cells any more than necessary. If you can use massage with passive range of motion exercises to gently assist the mobilization of joints and limbs for our patients in practice, it's always very important to use long gliding strokes, always work towards the heart. Obviously, where you have a patient with a heart condition, then you don't actually want to apply effleurage. That is a contraindication. Because we don't want to overload the heart with working harder than it already is, if it's already compromised. And you don't work with effleurage in the direction of the fur, it's always against the fur towards the heart. Your pressure and your rhythm will vary depending on the patient's requirements. I would recommend that you maybe look at a practical workshop where you can be shown practically on live dogs and you can look at the pressure that you should be applying, and the practical workshop will also go through the contraindications as well. So you're always going to work under veterinary direction, but mobilising the tissues and mobilising the joints is always going to help our patients, as long as we're always very mindful of what we're doing. So sports, so other massages that can be applied, and this is where external therapists may well be able to come in and work on patients for you, or work in the patient's home once the animal's been discharged. So we've got deep tissue massage, which is a stronger application of the Swedish massage, but it does allow the therapist to access the deeper muscle layers of the body that are working harder. So, you know, deeper muscle layers like the rhomboids, and whatnot. Sports massage is applied for injury identification and rehabilitation of soft tissues. So it's not just for sporting dogs. It is a remedial branch of massage and is especially helpful in supporting orthopedic issues, actually. So if you have any dogs in your practice with hip dysplasia, elbow problems, spinal issues, that can be really very helpful. Where you've got an acute spinal problem, obviously massage is contraindicated, but where you've got ongoing things like spondylosis and things like that, that's where it would come in. And it's very good at addressing common issues such as myalgia and muscle weakness, muscular strains, trigger points, and adhesions. So that can be very good. It's very important that you find a therapist if you're not doing the knowledge yourself in practice. Find a therapist that's knowledgeable of muscular origins and insertions and the actions of the muscles. They need to know what they're isolating, what they're treating, the fibre direction of the muscle for appropriate rehabilitation, so that they don't cause more problems. And then you have myofascial release work, which is a fantastic therapy. And this application works on the 3D cobweb of the fascia, and the restrictions within the fascia that do increase pain perceptions, that can then reduce limb range of motion. Working on the fascia will help to normalize the somatic function, promote muscular health and strength, and release any patterns of tension that the dog has in the body. So that can be very helpful. Now, stretching in practice, again, passive range of motion of the limbs alongside very gentle stretches can be very beneficial to dogs that are recovering from surgery or if they've had significant time spent convalescing and being generally inactive, actually. But it's very important. Waiting for a dog to vocalise that you've gone too far is way too far. So if in doubt, just do it, super, super gently, because you can cause more harm than good if you're overzealous. You must always work with intention, and be very mindful not to overstretch a limb, and not take it beyond its comfortable range of stretch for that particular animal. Just because you had a Labrador yesterday that could stretch so many degrees does not mean that the Labrador today can extend its leg in the same way. So you must take each individual on their own basis and what they can do. But perform slowly with a degree of patience. Stretching really can assist with encouraging normal muscular function. It will encourage the lengthening of the muscle, help decrease muscular tension, and help inhibit nociceptive pain. So it does bring, assist with pain relieving properties, and can be very relaxing, actually, for a lot of the dogs I found. Again, I would strongly recommend and encourage you to look at practical workshops to help you with this. There are contraindications to stretching, and they must be considered for every patient on an individual basis. I've motored through. So here we are, the end. This is a massive topic. Thank you so very much for joining me today. I hope that you found the CPD interesting and informative. There is so much to cram in. Look at further reading, further viewing of videos, especially concerning muscular contraction. Please, if you have any questions, I really would be happy to answer any questions you have. So if you wanted to send any, please go to emma.young@onpointdogs.co.uk, and I would be more than happy to help you with that. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Emma for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.